2, In Search of Black Power. I'm your host, Lawrence Grand Prix. Today, our episode is going to be on the myths of black buying power. This is an interview that we did with Morgan State University professor Jared Ball. He is the curator and host of I Mix What I Like, who has been a consistent supporter of LBS and New Timbuktu and this podcast, and in fact, many of the cuts from his archive have appeared on this feed. And Dr. Ball has a new book in which he takes on one of the most prominent pieces of political mythology within the black political community, which is the notion that if black people only spent their money better and spent it with black businesses, this could create political and economic sustainability and thriving within the black community. Dr. Ball goes into the studies and numbers that are the genesis of this myth and reveal these statistics don't actually reflect the reality of the black community's financial situation, not including the massive amounts of credit card debt and the general lack of wealth within the black community in these findings. Dr. Ball goes on to trace the hegemony of the myth, or at least much of it, to the power of black media, who is using stories about black buying power to attract advertising dollars from white businesses, promising them unique access to this large pool of potential consumers. This ironically puts black media in the position of offering up their audience as super consumers of white products, the exact forms of frivolous spending that these black media corporate enterprises often chastise their audiences for embracing. Finally, Dr. Ball locates the mythology of black buying power within the politics of the Cold War and wanting to promote a racially open vision of capitalism, which includes extending consumer power and especially entrepreneurship power under Nixon in the 70s, to black capitalists and black entrepreneurs. This current crop of black entrepreneurs promote the myth of black buying power in an attempt to create a political rallying cry for black communities who feel other forms of more comprehensive political change have been closed off to them. In the process, however, consumerism, entrepreneurship, and buying power take the place of radical, fundamental political and economic restructuring, a reality Dr. Ball is attempting to fundamentally shift in his book. So what this episode was designed to do a month ago, before the wave of protests broke out, was to give you an introduction to Dr. Ball's work by giving you a supercut of other interviews that he has done, basically giving you a best of his analysis of black buying power and getting it to my interview with Dr. Ball. Now, all of this was planned a month ago before the wave of protests, which has broken out in 140 cities around the country. Part of me was wondering maybe I should do an episode specifically around the protests, but I think given the amount of work that's gone into Dr. Ball's book, I think it makes more sense for me to put in this intro, attempting to link the politics of capitalism with policing and the notions of black entrepreneurship and buying power in a way that might actually be reflected in some of the discourses around our current wave of protests and debates around the value or dangers of things like destroying property as a legitimate political tactic. While the politics of using the tactic of destruction of property are not clear-cut, we can roundly reject the equivalent of destroying property as morally similar and on the same plane of so-called violence with the police violence rendered on black and brown bodies around the country. This sort of both-sidesism ignores basic, clear realities. Property can be insured and indeed replaced, while human lives cannot. The violence of the oppressed should never be evaluated within the same moral frame as the violence of the oppressor, especially when that violence is of a categorically different tenor, i.e. property violence as compared to violence against physical human beings. In places like Philadelphia, we can see bands of white vigilantes taking up baseball bats to protect businesses that they fear are being looted by these individuals. This willingness to equate businesses with personal individual freedom or culture, to the extent that bands of white vigilantes would take up weapons to protect them, reflects the power of the mythology of entrepreneurship these white ethnics in Philadelphia don't own stock in Target or Walmart, most likely. And they probably don't even own many of the businesses they see themselves as protecting. But in a very real cultural way, they see this notion of entrepreneurship and the ability to make money through entrepreneurship as so essential to what they view as the American dream, that they're willing to take arms against a largely theoretical threat that is challenging this property, which they have imbued with such deep cultural value. I believe this links to the conversation that I'm about to have with Dr. Jared Ball around the politics of black buying power in two ways. First, it's important to understand the police fundamentally as an entity employed by the state to protect the visions of what people in power deem as valuable. Disproportionately, those people are homeowning, affluent white people, and they view protecting their businesses as so essential, even though they are insured and even though, again, destruction of property is not equivalent to the destruction of life, that there is a political impetus towards using the police and indeed emboldening the police to use heavy-handed tactics to protect property. This is not about the inherent value of the property. It's about using police as a tool to protect a particular cultural and ethnic vision of what the good life is. And the good life is to be an entrepreneur. And what do we pay police for? But to protect our visions of what we deem as valuable. This is, of course, linked to gentrification, the increasing value of real estate within the city, and the need to demonstrate stability within the American urban core in order to continue to allow those property values to escalate. As such, entrepreneurship and this mythical vision of buying power as an expression of community solidarity becomes a rallying point through which individuals will actually advocate police action to protect this mythical community, which supports each other through entrepreneurship and patronizing each other's businesses, a reality which is fundamentally disrupted by these protesters. A second but related point is to understand the role in which the myth of black buying power allows this mythology of the value of entrepreneurship to infiltrate the black community. One of the more stunning revelations of the past week or so, and one that's very relevant for this podcast, is none other than Killer Mike, a rapper from Atlanta who's noted for advocating revolutionary violence against police officers in his widely circulated rap lyrics, has come out against the politics of property destruction within the context of people using that tactic in the city of Atlanta. His justification is similar to many other liberals and black folks in the community, that this property destruction is being led by largely outside individuals who enjoy seeing stuff burn, essentially, enjoy sticking it to the man, and aren't working with the community in a fundamentally strategic way to advance political demands, and as such, this property destruction is not strategic. I am very sympathetic to these claims. In fact, in many ways, I have deployed these claims myself. I, however, am not Killer Mike, a rapper known for advocating revolutionary violence against police in my lyrics. Additionally, I think it's important to understand that within the context of this moment, the notion of outside agitators risk ignoring the very real sense of hopelessness and political impossibility that's leading people to embrace property destruction as an expression of their justified righteous indignation. You would figure if anybody would understand this, it would be somebody like Killer Mike. I argue, and I believe the work of Dr. Jared Ball argues, that it's important to understand why someone like Killer Mike would have a hard time seeing this vision, explicitly because he has embraced a very similar vision around the importance of community entrepreneurship as liberation to those white folks picking up the bats in Philadelphia to protect their white businesses from black looters. This notion of circulating money, the barbershop, the investing in black banks as being so fundamental to community that it is more important than expressions of political outrage against police murder. It'd be one thing if Killer Mike were saying, we have a strategy to get police reform. You're not working within that strategy that we've been baking up for years around legislative change at state and local level. So you need to succumb to the leadership of black people on the ground who have a different vision of change than property destruction. That's not what Killer Mike is saying. And I don't believe that's what most folks who make the argument that Killer Mike is making. They're not making that argument. They're saying, look, we get that you're mad, but this stuff is bad for business. The business of black community is expressed through things like, again, the barbershop, the black bank, and other things that Killer Mike has explicitly advocated for. And that business becomes harder if we're having this property destruction as a core political motivation. So it's the mythology of black buying power as a way to express the most organic representation of black community, which justifies even radical voices like Killer Mike coming out against property destruction. I think those who make an argument similar to Killer Mike ignore some of the realities Dr. Ball's work is trying to isolate. Even if we agree on the importance of these ecosystems of black institutions, which are supported by black folks patronizing each other's businesses, each other's banks, each other's nonprofits, that infrastructure isn't being disrupted by these protests. It's being disrupted by white supremacy and global capitalism. The COVID epidemic is merely the most clear manifestation of the reality that without fundamental change on a massive scale, the institutions black folks use to express themselves, to build joy and express possibility within their own communities, will simply not have the resources or achieve the scale of change that can be called revolutionary. Unfortunately, embracing the myth of black buying power and this notion that if we could only get stable communities where we could circulate the dollar between different black institutions is embraced unquestioningly and uncritically by the black media, that we're willing to even potentially demonize the very tactics which could potentially, not assuredly, but potentially lead to that broad-based, fundamental, massive-scale change. Those tactics could risk being demonized in the name of holding on to the stability which allows for us to do the forms of black buying power-based enterprise that are so enjoyable, but at the end of the day, so limited. So that's what I have. I would like to do a future episode that begins to interrogate some of the dynamics around the protest, around some of the ways that some of our work may engage those protests and the issues raised in them sometime soon. But for now, we have a supercut of Dr. Jared Ball talking about his position on black buying power, and then we'll transition to our interview with Dr. Jared Ball around his brand new book, The Myth and Propaganda of Black Buying Power. So with that, thank you. We look forward to covering these protests as much as we can in the near future, and we hope you enjoy the show.
So I'm just trying to quickly lay the context, propaganda, colonialism, et cetera. So for this specific myth, and of course there are many, the claim that African America has roughly $1 trillion in buying power is popularly repeated mythology with no basis in sound economic logic or data. While the myth has a longer history, it is today largely propelled by misreadings and false interpretations of Nielsen surveys and marketing reports produced by the Selig Center for Economic Growth at the Terry College of Business, housed in the Bank of America Financial Center in Athens, Georgia. That alone should stop everybody. So Bank of America is going to produce studies that tell black people how powerful they are and that how what they can actually do to overcome the inequality that they suffer. Red flags should have already been going up. But as we're going to look at, most people don't even know this. And that's how propaganda works. If you can disassociate the origins and just have people focus on a catchphrase, $1 trillion in buying power, then it's easier to have that manipulate people and then for them to assume that this is true and start to operate that way and regurgitate this myth, usually for an applause line at a gathering like this. People will say to brothers and sisters, we got $1 trillion. And everybody's like, yes! If we would just stop buying the shoes and the weed and the, we would, yes.
So most people see the title, you know, we have a $1 trillion buying power, but in the black community, we don't benefit from it at all. Why is that?
Because black people are very good at giving their money away. We love supporting our masters, former masters. It's a habit, it's a tradition that we've had for hundreds of years, you know. But the biggest, worst examples I can think of, man, are cases of, like, athletes who've never been trained on financial literacy, who will literally earn $100 million over, say, a 10, 12-year period, and will just engage in extravagant amounts of spending that just don't make any sense. And what they don't understand is that when you have that kind of capital on that level, like somebody gives you $100 million, you can turn that into a billion in a generation.
If you're only counting what passes through us as a sieve rather than what actually increases wealth, then of course you can make these claims. I get a paycheck, I then just did it the other day. Almost all of it immediately, I look at my account and like for one half a day, it's like, oh yeah, all right, I'm good. But then here come all the apps. Your bill is due, your bill is due, your bill is due. And by the time I finish, I have that money literally like one day. And it just passes through me. Now, you could say, well, he could have bought a cheaper computer. He didn't have to buy this phone. He didn't have to get a car. He could buy less clothes or go to less movies or whatever, whatever, and say that all of us could do the same. But then let's just follow that through. If I took all the money that I spend on that, doing that, and didn't do that, where would I go with that money? And what would I replace those products with? Or what could I do with all the money I ended up saving? If you just start to think about how much you spend, and then think about what would happen if you didn't spend any of that for a year and just saved it and then took that pot, and then the way we're encouraged to think, well, then here's a number of things that happen. One, if you don't go to the hairdresser or to the clothing store or wherever, then those businesses die. Those people starve. They lose their homes. They lose their whatever. Capitalism works by circulating capital. It must keep moving. If you save it and don't spend it, the system will collapse. Maybe that's desirable, but in the process of that, a lot of other people are gonna be hurt. A lot of people that depend on your little bit of spending are gonna be hurt. Let's extend that. If all of us did that and we took all that money, we didn't buy anything all year, and we kept the same shoes and the same shirt and the same car and the same hair and the same computer and the same phone and the same, and we just bootlegged all our movies, which is, you know, and we did all of that. And we came together at the end of the year and we said, we're gonna pool all that money. Now, all of us in this room, let's say, I don't know, I'm guessing we might come up with a couple $100,000. I think that's a lot. That's not probably real either. But let's just say we did, a couple $100,000. What do we do with that money? Where are we gonna go with that money? First of all, it's just a couple $100,000. That is not enough to overturn the inequality in this economy. It's not enough to invest in something that's going to create wealth down the line that you can then hand down to your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, like wealth is done within wealthy community. So the function and development of mythology is that the process of colonization was itself a far-reaching psychological operation called psyops in the parlance of modern warfare. Propaganda and symbol manipulation were the colonialists' essential catechism for centuries. Colonialism itself was an ideology of combat. The metropole's propaganda, symbols, and myth-making were as crucial as bullets in the effort to pacify the colony. So again, myth-making propaganda are targeted, in this case, at Black America as any other colonized community, with the goal of pacifying the colony. Those in power view, whether we agree or not, it's important, I think, we understand how they view pop culture and media. And one of the things that they point out here is that the most effective kind of propaganda was defined as the kind where the subject moves in the direction you desire for reasons which he believes to be his own.
Now, let me ask you, it's something that I've said, you know, many times before. Black people are the most vain people I know, because we will spend our last on the most expensive stuff and we can't afford it. Why is it that we as Black people have to have the best car, the best clothes, the best hair, the best shoes, but yeah, when you go in a person's house, like say some of these single guys, they got all these nice clothes, but they're sitting on a soapbox inside of their apartment, but they look good. Why is that we have our priorities so screwed up financially?
Because some of us grow up believing deeply in instant gratification and doing things that make you feel good. Like, you think about a brother who's got, you know, 10 kids and 8 babies mamas. You know, this is clearly not a person who has engaged in long-term thinking or critical.
You all
thinking.
Saw Inception. Is that too old a movie? Did anybody not see Inception? Okay, I like to bring that up because it goes back to that point of propaganda, the film with Leonardo DiCaprio. And the point of that film is, how do they develop the ability to implant ideas so deep in someone's mind that they just think that they came to that conclusion on their own without being influenced? And propaganda is meant to work the exact same way. nobody looks into where the data, quote unquote, is coming from. So the report comes out and says, we have $1 trillion. One of the mistakes that is made is that, to their credit, Nielsen and the Selig Center are honest about what their reports are. They're saying, they're clear, we are not saying Black people have this much wealth. We're saying that they have this much buying power. What buying power means gets lost in the translation, and by the time we hear it in popular media regurgitated to us, it has no basis in reality. So this is what the report says. Despite historically high unemployment rates, Blacks have shown resiliency in their ability to persevere as consumers. Black buying power continues to increase, rising from its current $1 trillion level to a forecasted $1.3 trillion by 2017.
It's like a backhanded comment.
Of course. But it also doesn't make any sense if you think buying power means actual economic strength. It only makes sense if you understand, as we'll get to in just a moment, what buying power from their point of view actually does mean. Well, the Selig Center says buying power is disposable income, or the total personal income available for spending on goods and services after taxes. Simply defined, buying power is the total personal income of residents that is available after taxes for spending on virtually everything they buy, but it does not include dollars that are borrowed or that were saved in previous years. And this is where they're most honest. It is not a measure of wealth. It does not include, and it does not include what tourists spend in their visits. It seemed like people have this money, they pay their bills, and then they choose then to go out and buy the weed and the hair and whatever else. This is in itself misleading, including the line about that it does not include dollars that are borrowed in previous years. As real wages have stayed the same since the 1970s, but production has gone up, the gap to keep people buying the overproduced goods that they can no longer afford with their salaries was closed with credit card debt. So to say that people are spending money after they pay their bills, not including credit cards, makes it seem like, again, that Black people have all this money, when in reality, the average Black household has a net worth of $1,700. And an average credit card debt of $6,000 to $7,000. So you can't be financially strong if your net worth is six times less than your credit card debt. But anyway.
I'm just challenging African Americans to, instead of buying the next pair of Jordans, to take $100 of that money and to start an account at Citizens Trust Bank, or start an account with a Black banker trade union or smaller local banker trade union, and move your money in another direction. For the amount of Jordans that we as a people buy in this country, and we as a Black people specifically, if we take one or two of the pair of Jordans that we would buy through the course of a year, we can shift within 3 days $100 million to one Black bank. If you get 1 million Black people, like in a city like Atlanta, to one Jordan release, instead of buying the full 180, taking half of that money and starting a bank account, you can move $100 million into a Black bank. That money then turns into mortgages, turns into small business loans, turns into other things that help the community in a different way. So I'm not telling you to give up on wearing Jordans. I'm saying one pair of Jordans, instead of buying those Jordans, start a bank account in a place like Citizens Trust.
Circulating a few dollars within their communities, because we don't have any money. White wealth is not created by circulating it within white communities. White wealth is created by putting it into the global economy and exploiting everybody. That's how all these billionaires and trillions of dollars are generated. That's how wealth is created. So a Black bank, for instance, and I do talk about this in the book, can't make money for the community, because the community doesn't have enough to invest into it for the bank to take that money and put it into the global economy to then reinvest it back into the black community. But it's the black press in its own incentive to get money from white corporations that is helping drive this mythology. So one of the things that I look at in the book is just how often the black press promotes this myth without any discussion. And in fact, I've been one of the only people to raise any conversation with them about it. And what's ended up happening, as I discovered, is that over the years, even interviews I've done within the black press about this have literally disappeared. They're not even on their websites anymore. So many of those same voices are literally sponsored by those banking institutions. We get our black intellectual reporting and economic analysis sponsored by Bank of America and Wells Fargo and McDonald's. And that's who's sponsoring a lot of the people that are put before us. So that's why we have young people who just simply repeat. And the people that would raise these critiques are never put in front of a microphone or a camera. If you do the math just from their own phony mythology, black people only have 1/8 of the buying power that white people have. So even if you believe in the mythology, even there, we can't catch up. 1% of the population has half of the stock. 10% of the population has 90% of all the stock. So we can't buy stock. 4 wealthy white men have more land than all black people combined in this country. There's no land to buy. All of the factories and businesses have been shipped off to China. You just made it so there's nothing to invest in. We don't have any money to invest. We have had political organizations replaced by nonprofits. We've had activists replaced by self-help and life coaches. We've had analysis of capitalism replaced with credit card gurus and financial literacy training set. This is why we're not able to understand what's going on here. People don't want to be seen as, if I agree with Dr. Ball, then that means that I'm disagreeing with Du Bois, Garvey. That means if I have to be seen as agreeing with Jared against Farrakhan and against Malcolm and against Amos and against Claude. And then they're like, well, who the hell is Jared? And yeah. I agree. Who the hell am I?
Right.
But the point is, don't agree because it's me and don't disagree because I'm not them. Look at the substance of the argument. Buying power that is being measured is the power we have to transfer what little money we have to someone else. It is not about a power to improve our overall economic condition. So I don't know exactly what I'm going to do or what has to happen, but I am confident that I've proven here that this is not the way. So if my only contribution is to say, let's just not go that way and pick another direction,
right,
I'll have to be satisfied with that.
Jared Ball, thanks for appearing here on In Search of Black Power. How you doing?
I'm as good as could be expected. Thanks for having me.
So, we've talked a little bit about your book, and I just wanted to break down some of the arguments in the context of some of the ways that I hear this myth of black buying power getting deployed. So, one of the things that I think many people in the black community consistently hear is, oh, if we only did it like insert X ethnic community here, whether it be the Koreans or people of Jewish descent, this mythical notion that other ethnic groups have been able to lift themselves into the American mainstream through pooling their resources and buying collectively. Were you able to get into any of the research around this? Or can you just talk generally about the unique situation black folks are in that complicate this mythology?
Research going back several decades now talks about, number one, the overall gaps in general class position between every group that so-called legally immigrates to this country and Black Americans, meaning that every group that comes here, again, so-called legally, comes here from a better economic condition than the average African-descended Black American here in the United States. So from the beginning, where we end up interacting with a lot of these different groups, whether they're in the African diaspora or throughout the Asian diaspora or anywhere else, we're often dealing with segments of the population that, relative to their own population and certainly relative to us, are doing better. So we're not dealing with them as collectives. We're not dealing with them, again, in terms of their relationship to the economy here or if from wherever they're coming. So when the conversation comes up around here, why we were in a predominantly Black section of this community, why isn't that a Black-owned store? The point remains the same. Well, one, we're not looking at the conditions of the people who work there. So we're saying we should own the store. Well, that's fine. Okay. And perhaps that's true. But to suggest that this is a panacea or a pathway to equality is mistaken. We miss the fact that they're giving money to support probably many more in their home country, in their family. And then, of course, we're missing the fact that this is not closing the income or wealth inequality that exists in their country or within their segment of population here in this country relative to white America. And then lastly, one point that I only touch on very briefly, more broadly, but again, this deserves so much more discussion, is that most of these arrangements, the restaurant owners, the store owners, the laundromat owners, whoever we find in our communities, the hair, the nails, and et cetera, is backed by federal policy, both in their home country here and here in the United States. Again, in some cases, going back more than 100 years, where, for instance, in the case of the Chinese, the federal government here made an arrangement with the Chinese government that basically said, we don't want more Chinese people here. And if you're going to send more of your people here, they can only come with arrangements and agreements to set up businesses in only certain sectors of the economy. So in other words, as I end up arguing in the book, this is why I keep coming back to, we need to address ourselves to public policy more than specifically or only or with a sole focus on economics and certainly not buying power.
That's really interesting. So I wanted to read a segment, not from your book, but from something you quote in the book, because I think it sets up an interesting conundrum that might be surprising to some folks when they think about it. So it's on page 44. By 2015, African-American buying power is estimated to gain a whopping 35%, hitting $1.2 trillion, up from $913 billion in 2008. African-Americans are mega consumers, beating out all other ethnic groups in the consumption of automobiles, wine and spirits, baby care, products, groceries, health and beauty products, personal care, apparel, electronics, movies, travel, and entertainment. So that's from a press release from this BET Networks consortium of many entities that are basically selling Black media networks to white advertisers. And I think it's so interesting because, as you point out, many of these Black media networks kind of chastise Black people on their media airwaves. If you only consumed better, we would lift ourselves out of poverty. Yet their business model basically necessitates Black folks continuing to spend disproportionately large amounts of money with the very white mega corporations that these Black media companies often bring on speakers to chastise people for over-consuming. So can you talk about some of just your experience with the Black media ecosystem and the sort of chastising of Black consumption that happens, yet these Black media outlets, by necessity often, are dependent upon these white advertisers?
Look, this is one of, for me, it's the classic, the cliche case that researchers talk about or we hear talked about all the time, where you begin an investigation with a certain hypothesis or a certain focus. And in the process of doing the research, other elements are revealed and illuminated and maybe even take a central position that you hadn't previously considered possible or even considered at all. And for me, this is certainly the case in terms of the role that the commercial Black press has played and continues to play in promoting this mythology and the interests behind it. I honestly, in the years that I had been trying to, look at this myth, hadn't really investigated this element or this aspect of it until I took time to sit down and start going through the kind of reporting that has been brought to bear on this subject over the years. And what is revealed is, well, not only, again, is the concept itself a marketing and advertising concept. It's not one to, again, assess actual economic strength, but that it's one that's developed and promoted and taken advantage of by this small segment of this Black commercial press and with great magnifying effect. So just as you're saying, I mean, their incentive is to project a mythology, a mythological economic condition to white advertisers to collect this, more than 400, almost 500, I think, billion at this point spent annually by advertisers just on media generally, and this big pool of money, of course, you know, commercial presses of all backgrounds are going to say, I want my fair share. But it's in relationship specifically to us, to Black people here, that it's just sort of, it's just developed, again, in league, you read it there, in league with the Black press themselves, wanting to concoct this myth. And again, when you look at the, as I tried to do in the book, when you look at the methodology behind the numbers, it is so poor. It's just poor. But promoting it garners them ad revenue, but conversely projects, well, really, I should say it this way, it's an inverse relationship between what is taken in terms of ad revenue by the Black commercial press and what is given out to us as consumers of that reporting. And the damage it does to our ability to understand or interpret or analyze our economic and material condition. And as I try to point out in the book, it becomes axiomatic, unquestioned reality, simply because it's propelled by a Black commercial press that, understandably, a lot of people are going to take without, you know, much thought. Of course, if it's repeated and reported over and over and over and over and over again by BET, by Essence, by The Root, by, you know, The Griot and Blavity and whoever. And then, of course, by the white commercial press, if it's just going to continue to get that reverberating, you know, power, it's just going to have that much more of an impact and be that much more difficult to crack in terms of breaking through the spell of the myth.
So one of the segments towards the end of the book, I think, was not surprising because I think I'd seen it before, but just stunning was in the context of how you present the data, this cooperative relationship between the institution of Black Lives Matter and some of these Black banks, where you have these sort of shimmering Black figures on these Visa debit cards, and mm-hmm. just sort of the acceptance of this seemingly radical activist movement of this very traditional, limited, though people hate the term, sort of neoliberal vision of power. So can you just talk about sort of how this turn of events reflects some of the theory of power that these institutions have been trying to promote for decades, and just sort of some of the alternative visions of power that you're trying to hold up in your book?
I think that this is one of the areas in which the myth has room to breathe, is in the lack of solidity in much of the organization, the lack of political education or political clarity or ideological clarity in much of the formations that, again, take on the label of Black Lives Matter. I don't mean to attribute this to any one particular person or group or to blame the concept for my critique here. What I'm saying is that in the what I think is just a general profound moment of disorganization that we find ourselves in, Black Lives Matter as a concept has not, I think, provided enough of the political structure that we need. And though this is not a point I make in the book, I think this is what ends up being played out in the book, that because of this lack of clarity and a lot of the confusion imposed upon us that I do talk about in the book as a mechanism of talking about the process of how this myth is promulgated and sustained, they're able to succumb in many ways to the pressures of the myth and to the promises of the myth. And in a moment where, you know, look, when I first brought this up, some Black Lives Matter representatives took umbrage with my raising of the critique, and their response was specifically in one instance to tell me that this was generating money to develop bond or bail bond payments to get people out of jail when many of our people get locked up and can't afford that. And this relationship with One United Bank and the promotion of a debit card using very African-centered and radical iconography and symbolism, with the suggestion that, again, Black buying power and a debit card is a pathway to achieving the Black Lives Matter call for you know, equality or freedom or whatever. Their argument was that this was generating some positive, that this was, achieving some material goal that I wasn't sufficiently, crediting. And fair enough. But in terms of my book, this is why I try to just stay on the sole focus of the myth. The myth is, I think I prove, is a myth. One of the ways it gets carried is through these promises of black banking and buying black and supporting black capitalist commercial institutions, be they a bank or be they a commercial press, as sort of a promise towards collective national black uplift. This is, again, part of how the myth functions. The promise, which, again, in the book and others have done a greater, you know, amount of work than I on this subject, the promise of black banking cannot be realized in terms of a collective benefit. A debit card is not a pathway to liberation. I think there's a wild and dangerous contradiction between putting a very comedic and African-centered symbolism and black liberation language on these debit cards and to take on the cultural, the pop cultural politics of people like Kendrick Lamar and say that we are going to be all right. In other words, it's co-opting all of the imagery that we all use in a variety of ways to sustain ourselves and to build our movements, but it's being done so for a very commercial, individual, private ownership, capitalist enterprise. The myth shields itself, it cloaks itself in this symbolic blackness, pridefulness, and progressiveness. So criticism of it is has to go through series of layers before it can penetrate. Mm-hmm. And as I said, and I'll just wrap it up here, I'm sorry to go so long, but as I said, you said to that several of those Black Lives Matter critics of me, that all I'm trying to point out to you is that one way or another, you're promoting a mythological economic reality. Whatever good it's doing, that I think is creating more damage, more broadly speaking.
Yeah, so this is the place to go long, so don't worry about time. That's okay. The beauty of the podcast format, as I'm sure, you know, hopefully we realize. So it's a quote that I think about a lot, and I think it really gets to some of the understandable limitations of the thinking presented by many folks trying to think about this issue. It is that the human mind's inability to understand the exponential function is one of its greatest evolutionary limitations. We just have a hard time dealing with scale. We have a hard time dealing with thoughts about billions of dollars. And we have a hard time understanding the difference between a black bank doing a few good things, having a few decent job training, entrepreneurship training, and mortgage programs, to scaling up to a holistic solution to white supremacy. So just talk a little bit about some of the things you talk about in terms of the limits of black banks within our current capitalist framework, in terms of how they really make money, what is their true scale in relation to the size of the problems black folks face, and just the nature of, even in the best case scenario, where as Killer Mike says, we all stop buying Jordans and all put our money in black banks, it does not scale up exponentially to be able to address the problems many of these folks are trying to get at.
The reason I put propaganda in the title of the book, and the reason that that's so much of my focus, is because I'm not a trained economist, and I'm not an untrained or autodidact, self-trained radical economist either. I'm someone who studies political economy and certainly has attempted to study a lot of the reporting about economy and the economics, particularly of black people here in the African diaspora. But not having that background, a lot of what I've had to do over the years is try to just learn on the fly. And in the context of this book, lean on some more expert work, particularly of Marissa Baradaran and her book, The Color of Money, and then several others and several sources that she and Professor Nathan Connolly at Johns Hopkins have put me onto as sort of off-the-record supportive help. And in short, what I've learned is that there's a radical and I think an important macro look that Vladimir Lenin talked about in terms of the role banks play in capitalism and imperialist development. And essentially, they're there to organize capital and marshal it for those who own and control it and to make it work on the world stage for those who own it. Banks are not there to redistribute wealth and create equality and upend poverty, et cetera, and so forth. They're there to manage, if anything, the wealth made from the exploitation of the poor. So they're part of that process. So that's one thing on a macro level that I think is at least important to bring up in these conversations, even though I don't address this in the book. But in terms of what I do look at in the book is that banks, there's a reason why we have the same amount of black banks that we had, which is about 23 that we had in 1969. There's a reason why there are still a relatively similar amount of small banks, even, you know, white small banks in terms of the national landscape of banking, because small banks, which are often equated in terms of their struggles to black banks, because black banks are almost by definition small banks, the reason that they can't expand is because they're dealing with populations whose deposits are small. You need money to make money. So we could start there. The amount of deposits that go into black banks are being deposited by black earners who are earning far less than their white counterparts, who don't have, who are not inheriting houses and estates to then deposit and invest. And they're not inheriting the stock, which is owned almost exclusively by the top 10% of the population anyway. So we're not able to bring large sums of money to banks. And one important part that I learned about this situation is that as a result, particularly black banks end up losing money servicing the deposits of the small deposits of their relatively black populations with small amounts of earnings. In other words, when you deposit money into an account and it sits in a savings account and collects interest, the bank is paying. They're losing money on that. And if the amounts of deposits don't pool into large enough sums that can then be taken out and invested on the national and global markets, which is what banks do, to then be brought back in with greater returns, to then be reinvested back into the community with expectations of those loans being paid back, then you can't expand. So again, when black people who don't earn deposit money in a black bank, that black bank loses money servicing the interest and all that goes into, and you know, something I never thought about, you know, tellers are being paid, the people won't, the managers are being paid. So it costs money to run a bank. It costs money to then pay the interest on the money that's being deposited in those banks. And then if those pools aren't enough to turn into, flip into bigger sums of money on a larger market, and the people that would come in from the community to borrow to develop a business or buy a home aren't going to be expected to be able to pay it back because of all that is associated with this, the white supremacy that by itself devalues the property of a black home simply because it's black for no other reason. So if you start a black business with a business loan, who's going to support that business? Other poor black people who don't make a lot of money? That's not going to expand your business. So in other words, there's not enough money, you know, in the community to develop into larger sums, to have these banks turn into something that's going to somehow break from its then capitalist moorings and become something else by redistributing the wealth to help the collective. So the idea that somehow black banking, again, as I was pointing out with the Black Lives Matter piece, the idea that collectively putting money in a privately owned institution who only exists to flip money in a capitalist system to make more money for itself is somehow going to be redistributed to help the collective woes is, again, mythological fantasy. And then lastly, if, as I show in the book, you pool all, if for some magical reason you could take all of the black-owned banks and all of the so-called minority banks and pool them into one bank that would somehow fantastically use all of that pool of wealth for all of those communities, that bank wouldn't even break into the top, I think, 15 or 16 of the top banks just in this country alone, the top white banks in the country alone, who dwarf that collective total by hundreds of billions of dollars. I mean, they're in these top banks, J.P. Morgan, Chase, and one other slipping my mind off the top of my head, Wells Fargo, I think, are in the trillions of dollars of holdings just by themselves, which dwarfs the collective, I think, of all those banks combined. I think I looked it up. It would be somewhere several hundred billion dollars. It wouldn't even, I don't even think, it doesn't even meet a trillion. In other words, it's dwarfed in relative size to just those three banks alone. And again, this presupposes some sort of unity among all so-called minority banks, not just the black banks, that itself would be fantastical to imagine. So it's, and anyway, it's, I think, a lot more complicated than people walking into a room and saying, pull our money into a black bank And it's going to help us. And since you mentioned him, one of the reasons why I think it's important that we raise this critique and raise a critique of the arguments of people like Killer Mike and T.I. and others, as I try to in the book, is because when they go out, as I've seen them, and talk on our behalf on these issues, they are quick to tell us that those of us not from the hood and not from the corners where they slang and did all the things that they did, then we shouldn't speak on those experiences. And yet I find them having an overwhelming willingness to speak on issues of politics and economics and political organization when I have not seen them in the spaces that I've been in for decades. So in other words, if I can't go to the hood and talk about what's going on the corner, then I feel like that same level of vetting should go into who's speaking on our behalf when it comes to politics, economics, and radical organization. Because again, I've been in meetings and in spaces for decades and haven't seen there one of them in any of these spaces. So I'm wondering, why then do they seem so confident, and are they being positioned by others to speak so prominently on our behalf? When in this case, it's specifically on these issues that Killer Mike and T.I. and others like them, Jay-Z and others, are woefully inaccurate.
I think this is a good point to begin to transition to. I don't want to call it solutions, but to maybe think through things in terms of competing systems and what different strategies will produce from a systemic level. Because I think I want to talk about how emotional this argument gets in terms of people really trying to defend this argument. And I think what's happening, as you're pointing out, people aren't defending it from the sufficiency standpoint in their minds. I think they're defending it from the necessity standpoint and from the perspective of, well, do you want us all to just kind of work in shitty service economy jobs versus being entrepreneurs? And so I think a lot gets projected onto this conversation that I want to unpack just a little bit, because one thing I think about a lot is just the nature of service economy work being so prevalent. And one thing I'll never forget is hearing about how they teach people to retrain them how to smile once they get out of jail so they can be hired as like greeters in Walmart. And just not only is that a bad job, it's an existentially crushing scenario to be a black man in the inner city and feel like the only thing that I have that's valuable in our current capitalist economy is to make white people feel good in some crappy service economy job. So I think what people are oftentimes defending when they say we should pool our resources and be entrepreneurial is existentially, I don't want to exist in the world in a fundamentally subservient way, which is all I see if we cut off the route of black entrepreneurship in terms of service economy. I know that's not what you're saying, but I think that's what a lot of people are hearing. So I just wanted to get your comments on that, because I think about that a lot when I think about your argument and the way people respond to your argument.
No, I think it's a great point. And one of the reasons why I was happy to finally get this book done with whatever imperfections exist in it is because for so many years, I have gotten a variety of responses, and a majority of the criticism is born, obviously not out of study, because just folks have not studied this. And for a long time, I hadn't either. It's an emotional response. And I think the way you describe it is exactly right. So I do want to be clear, and I know you're not suggesting I'm saying this, but it is often misunderstood this way. I am not arguing at all that anybody should give up on any of their entrepreneurial dreams or endeavors. And look, without getting too autobiographical, I'm here. I sit before you as someone who put himself through great risk, you know, relative levels of trauma, specifically to avoid those jobs, specifically knowing that I could not exist in those jobs and did not survive in those jobs. So I understand the desire to break away from any number of career paths or imposed job paths to try to carve out some degree of sovereignty, even on an individual level. I fully understand that. In fact, one of the, again, not to be overly autobiographical, but one of the things that appealed to me about the academic world there were some other things I was clearly naive about in terms of, you know, what our job and relationship to struggle is supposed to be, et cetera. But one of the, what appealed to me was that it did grant me an escape from those kinds of, as you said, existentially crushing jobs. So I fully understand that. All I am trying to say with my argument about buying power is that it is, these are not pathways to collective Black national overthrow or revolution. So if people want to say whatever they want to say about their individual entrepreneurial endeavors or their support of Black businesses or their support of Black banking, all of that is fine. I'm not even in this instance attempting to discourage any of that. Support all Black businesses, deposit all of your money in Black banks. Please do, by the way, read the section of in my book where I have the exchange with the head of the industrial Black-owned bank here in Washington, D.C. Please at least acknowledge and see for yourself that I think that that is so clear that even they are either unaware or unable or unwilling to talk publicly and accurately about this subject. So at least understand that the bankers themselves seem unclear about how the economy works and what is and is not buying power. But do all of that. All I am saying is just we cannot continue to argue. It does us no good to argue politically, tactically, that this is a pathway to collective uplift. We cannot consume. We cannot save. We cannot invest our way to national liberation. In part, I think, look, I don't like what I'm very uncomfortable, I admit, raising this point, but I think it's, you know, we just have to be honest, and it is an accurate point to make, that even it is as difficult as it may be, if we make an honest assessment of just white America, and white America with all of its white supremacist and anti-Black advance or leg up or advantage, I should say, relative to the rest of us. Even in that community, they are struggling along class lines. The idea that all white people are enjoying this white supremacist capitalist society equally is itself pure fantasy. We may not see it. We may not get to have it projected at us in the same way or at the same levels, but to deny that it exists would be to again, walk away from reality. So my point in that is to say that even they can't create a situation in their own advantaged arrangement for their whole community to be taken care of. So the idea that we can on some level replicate versions of what they're doing to have it satisfy the national need is, again, mythology. So that's really all I'm trying to say here. I don't mean to discourage anything. In fact, I continue to say anything that has ever been on the table in terms of a political struggle in this country should be and still be on the table now. I just don't want, in this instance, for Black buying power to be raised an argument for collective revolution, and I certainly want it to stop being used as a bludgeon to blame ourselves and blame the poorest among us for our collective disadvantage.
I think that's really interesting. We've talked about this a little bit in other conversations where I think when people talk about buying power, what they, and this might be my projection, are saying is we need to embrace strategies that focus on our ability to control the institutions and things that impact our lives in a fundamental way. And I think one thing that's really powerful in my mind is to say, okay, if you want that power, we're never going to have that until we have stuff like universal health care, because at any moment, you can get a $20,000 medical bill that wipes out all your savings. So we're never going to really have true autonomy until we understand how we're systemically undermined in some fundamental ways. Now, those folks might counter, that's why we got to own our own medical insurance company and our own hospital. And I think that's where just the inability to understand the scale of, we're talking about billions and billions and billions of dollars to create that sort of infrastructure, kind of makes it hard for those arguments really to hold water. So what we talked about on previous calls was there is this nostalgia for this mystical moment where the Black community seemed to be able to take care of itself by itself. And I think part of that is some people thinking about segregation and the institutions of black businesses that existed then, but I think a lot of it is the post-World War II moment. And I think a lot about how, even if you saw that as a moment where wages were high and unions were strong, that was off of a militaristic, violent Cold War moment where a lot of those folks were working in military contracting, or so the military adjacent. It doesn't seem like it's going to come back. And even if it could come back, would we want it to come back, given the moral and geopolitical ramifications of how that moment came to be? So can you talk about just sort of the moments where it seems like the economic system was creating black buying power that was really working? And just sort of, you know, you talk about the politics of the Cold War a little bit in your book, and maybe just kind of using that as a way to talk about what I really am interested in, is just this moment in time from, you know, whenever you want to start at 45 to the early 70s or late 60s, where that was this, you know, sort of mystical golden era that politicians and everyone seems to want to go back to. But is that really the best frame to use?
Well, in some ways, I think it is a good frame. I would say I think it's a good time period to look at if the frame is, I think, more appropriately adjusted. And look, we're seeing we're seeing that moment in a sort of intensified microcosmic way right now because of the COVID crisis. But we're just not seeing it operate properly, so to speak, or the right ways. And what I mean by that is, when people point to the moment you're talking about at the end of the Second World War, where there seemed to be this opening of the economy for black people, for even white laborers and others to get jobs and get a leg up, and for business to start to turn around. Of course, as you point out, it's on the backs of a military campaign that left the United States as the singular hegemonic power in the world. But my point about the comparison to now is that it's the real result of government, federal, public policy and funding and supplementing of business, private business, but also just working people in general through federally funded workers programs, GI bills, et cetera, and so forth. Now, in terms of where, just to quickly dovetail back to a previous part of the conversation, where we look at the differences in groups' experiences, because this is also a moment, by the way, where black GIs, unlike, for instance, Jewish GIs, could not access, certainly at the same rates, if at all of those veteran home loans and veteran GI bills to go to school. And that's where a lot of economists point to the real break in terms of the relationship to the economy held between black people and Jews after the Second World War. And my point there is that, again, the difference is not because Jews are somehow better or smarter. It's because they got federal policy backing them at ways black people did not, that gave them the leg up in the economy. Now, again, you match that with a lot of the other parts of this, with the white supremacy and other, you know, conservative politics, Zionism, et cetera, and you get the full story. But in terms of this particular argument about what we can do, et cetera, that has to be understood. So as you're talking about the broader context after the Second World War, where the United States is saying, okay, well, we're now the most dominant power in the world. The best way for us to maintain it, well, internationally, we need to project the supremacy, not only of whiteness, but of capitalism, and specifically U.S. American-dominated Western capitalism, onto the rest of the world. And then locally, one of, if not the primary thing after wiping out the broader labor movement, is to suppress the most domestically enslaved and colonized, internally held colony, just black people. So what do we do? And this is where this mythology of buying power really takes hold, because the propaganda that was developed, and it was developed as propaganda specifically as such, to do all that could be done throughout the institutions in the United States to promote the concepts and wed the concepts of democracy and capitalism and freedom and capitalism their concern was solidifying this American hegemony around capitalism and blunting all tendencies towards communism or socialism around the world. And part of the way to do that is to project a version of American capitalism that is open to even the formerly enslaved. So let's put more Negroes on TV. And they literally talked about put more Negroes in films and put more celebrities out and use this as part of the array of psychological warfare against us here, against everyone abroad, to suggest that this place is actually better and more open than it is. And when the black commercial press took hold of that, I mean, it helped solidify the concept of the mythology of buying power and the potential for black entrepreneurialism and black capitalism to thrive among our communities in ways that create those primordial waters, political waters, economic waters that we're still swimming in. One of the impacts of segregation was to create sort of a fantasy in the potential of segregation. And so we often hear about Rosewood or Black Wall Street or how good things were when how much better things were in the classroom or in the community under segregation. And where some of that is certainly true, economically, the reality is that there could be no expansion. And in some ways, the white supremacist destruction of, for instance, Black Wall Street and other attempts at Black sovereignty, one of the, I maybe think, unintended impacts of that white supremacist terror was the cognitive terrorism that it continues to play on our ability to assess our economic condition. Because the reality, unfortunately, is that were dynamite not dropped on Tulsa, were vigilantes not going through the city, in streets, assassinating people randomly had the city been allowed to more or less go on unmolested by white supremacist terror, what would have been realized eventually is that all that would be developed is a small black bourgeoisie and a stagnant economy that can't expand. Because as I was trying to point out earlier, black people don't make enough money to have that money invested in the larger economies to be reinvested back into our economy with any great effect. As Marissa Baradaran and others have pointed out, as she says, you can segregate people, but you cannot segregate money. So this mythology that has come up attendant to these myths about segregation is the circulating dollar. But I implore people, as I did, to look for citations anytime you see this thing referenced, and you'll never find one because it's not real. Wealth is not created by the dollar rotating, circulating over and over and over within a given community. That's not how wealth is generated. Wealth is generated by capital being invested on broader markets and then reinvested back into a community. And then even there, the effect is to create a pocket of very wealthy and descending degrees of the poor, all the way down to those who are despondent, as we see in every group of people anywhere in the world, even among the most powerful white communities. So, and to the extent that we don't, as Nkrumah pointed out 50, 60 years ago, it's still true. The relative socialism we see in Scandinavian countries is born on the backs of the colonial relationships they have to Africa and Latin America and Eastern Europe and Asia and the so-called mm-hmm. Middle East. So again, this idea that we can just replicate these mythological models that don't exist in reality for other people is itself mythology.
So kind of getting to that, so that may not be how wealth is created, but is wealth creation the only metric that we should be using? And I guess that's what I was trying to get at in my previous conversation, whereby it may not create wealth, broad-based wealth, but it is a mechanism that we can use to sustain some of the civic infrastructure that makes life pleasant for many black folks in these communities.
Absolutely.
And one thing to add on to that, just to kind of reflect some of my scholarly and personal research, the numbers we use to understand how much money is in the black community, as you said, these economic numbers are not very good. And I think one of the things that maybe is a subtext of some of the people who support this argument is there's a ton of quote unquote black market or gray market economic activity in the black community, survival hustle economics, which is not counted in any of these economic measures of how much money is circulating in the black community. So in terms of fundamentally reshaping the economic circumstance, maybe that's not where it's going to happen. But in terms of producing, you know, civic community groups or producing small-scale entrepreneurial opportunity, isn't that far more likely? And given how important that is for the civic fabric of black and brown communities, can we at least understand how and why people are so adamant about prioritizing that as part of the solution?
Again, I don't mean in any way to disrespect or disparage that reality. And I fully appreciate that. As you describe it, the civic or cultural fabric of the community absolutely benefits from this. I am no different in this regard from anybody else. When we go to rent parties, when we go to fish fries, when we go to Happy Natural Days, when we go around to black vendor cultural expos, where we go wherever, even where the politics are not my own, I get it. It's enjoyable. I want to be there. I want to be around the foods and the people, and I want to see pretty black people selling other pretty black people their own black-owned goods, and I want to see pretty black people wearing those black-owned goods and smelling good and looking good and enjoying the vibe, and I love it. I love it. And I go to the Panamanian festivals with my wife and her family, and I love it. And then the same things are happening. I mean, I love it. There's no the salsa, the go-go, the rhythms. I give me all that all day, every day. All I'm saying is the feeling good of it, as important as that is, it is essential, should be thought of as playing that role and that role only. My only issue is when we take it from that to it being imposed on us as some sort of political or economic analysis, and often used to condemn us for our behavior as if our behavior is what is causing our poverty. And that is exactly not the case. So that's all I'm trying to say in all of this, that we should, if for that reason alone, that is why I myself, even with what I think I've done with this research and what I think I know about this subject, when I have the opportunity to, even at great inconvenience, to support or to be around black and brown people, that's what I do. But that's separate from what I understand to be the necessity here for what we have to do if freedom is actually what we want. So lastly, I would just want to say, this is why I think power, the concept of power as we traditionally understand it, is not what it means in the phrase buying power, which is only meant to mean the ability to enrich those who own the goods that we are buying. The power we're looking for, the only real power we have is in our social and political and organizational power. That's what I think we need to tap into. And if we address ourselves to that in terms of dealing with the material conditions of all of us, we'll come out with much better solutions. And if we leave the other enjoyable aspects out of the support of our businesses to just that is the support of these individual small businesses, which we want to, and the appreciation for what, as I think you said brilliantly, if I'm doing it justice, the civic and cultural fabric of our communities, that's beautiful. That's the balance. That's the dare I say, a dialectic I think we could do well to work with.
I think that is really where the heart of the conversation is. An understanding that I think part of, to wrap up, what may be happening is that people are seeing, you know, people go by what they see, and they see these businesses, and they see, you know, thousands of people gather for a festival, and they think that's what power is. But in terms of the scale of the economic violence being done through something like the war on drugs, or the scale of the economic deracination done through massive deindustrialization, those essential community sustaining efforts are not sufficient. So outside of substantial policy change, outside of substantial organizing, we're not going to be able to protect those institutions and get them to the scale where they can do sustainable cultural or even economic work to fundamentally change our conditions. And I think that's where I would like to see more people really understand your work and engage it and really have a fundamental conversation around some of these things. Last thing I'll say is I think that one good example of this, like we've talked about this before, is the whole cannabis economics thing, where people get really into cannabis festivals and wanting black folk to be able to sell weed, and of course they should, but the billions and billions of tax dollars being harvested from these legal cannabis sales, those need to go back into our community so we can actually begin to dig out from the war on drugs. But when we focus so much on the pure business side, because that's where the fun is, that's where the cool is, we miss some of the larger structural economic stuff that may be necessary for us to really do structural change. So I think that that's something I think about a lot. I think that's some of the implications that we're trying to draw from some of the work that you're doing.
Well, I appreciate that, because I've seen some of the work that you do. I've seen a lot of your work, but some of the, specifically the work that you do around the cannabis legislation. And I'm glad that you raised that point, because ultimately, and this is why I'm saying in the book that we should address ourselves to the gross domestic product of the United States, that $20 trillion and target it for redistribution, and begin to move beyond questions of who's the owner and what, you know, ownership and entrepreneurialism and business, to redistribution of the wealth that's created. And if we deal with that end of, I think, again, ultimately we would have many, much more fruitful outcomes. So for instance, to your point, economically, we cannot catch up. So exactly as many of us predicted years ago when this was all, you know, emerging, as soon as marijuana became legal to sell, there would be, of course, white pockets of capital ready to invest and take over. And as I've seen you present on and talk about and come up with the, I can't even remember how much you were saying, the tens of millions of dollars it takes. So this idea, you know, so there was never going to be some weed is legal, black people have a new avenue in the economy to exploit. No, of course that's not going to happen. So instead, what the question should be, as I think I'm hearing you say, the wealth that's being created from the legalized marijuana industry needs to be redistributed. And it's funny you say, because just this morning I'm listening to a commercial television outlet talk about and lament and give that fake, it's almost akin to what I'm arguing that a lot of our pundits and fake radicals do when they make these claims about buying power. You know, these commercial media pundits go on TV and they generate a lot of false credibility by saying, oh, well, where's the black ownership in the NBA, and black people is 60% of the NBA, and there's no NBA ownership, or nobody in the NFL, or whatever it is. There's no owner, one Jordan, one in the NBA and none in the NFL, whatever. What are we going to do about all, and we need more black ownership? And I keep saying, I don't think that's the question. The question shouldn't be more black ownership. The question shouldn't be, let's get one Jay-Z or one black owner in there. Let's get one Michael Jordan owning a basketball team. The question should be, since all these black people are populating are producing the raw material in terms of the players that produce all the wealth, why, instead of saying to the NFL, hire more black coaches and more black owners, or make room for more black owners, just say, instead of the revenue from the NFL being split, I think, 50-50 between the 30 owners and the thousands of players, say all the players get 90% of the money that's generated, and then the color, the background of the owner becomes irrelevant. If we say that the wealth that is created from the cannabis sales is redistributed in massive sums back to the communities that need it most, to our communities in particular, then it doesn't matter who the owner is, because we're all getting the wealth that comes back, that we're all getting wealth back to us that we have helped to create. And this is my point about the GDP. We are, when the person who goes to the dispensary to buy their weed is contributing to the $20 trillion GDP just as much as the person who is selling the weed, running the dispensary, growing the weed out in the field. Because if nobody's there to buy it, then the seller has no purpose, and the person running the dispensary also loses their purpose. So we all need, as I keep trying to jokingly say, a hashtag respect my consumption movement, to say that the purchaser is just as important. important and should benefit from the wealth created from that purchase just as much as the so-called owner and the grower and whoever else. And then we don't have to worry about, do we have X amount of black people owning and X amount of women and X amount of LGBTQ? Because at the end of the day, as we've seen in media and anywhere else, it doesn't matter who the owners are, because they run off and behave like their classmates. Or more importantly, and I know we don't have time to continue this part of the conversation, it's in terms of media, at least, it's the ad revenue that, going back to the beginning of our conversation, it's the ad buyers that determine the content, not the owner of the media. So either way, we're going to be on the short end of the stick. And that's why I think we should just be talking about getting a greater share of the wealth that we're all creating rather than focusing on who owns what and who has what business.
Mm-hmm. And just to round out that last example, when you look at the cannabis conversation in the corporate media, it is focused a lot on ownership. And some of the nuances that get lost is when you legalize cannabis, you create a powerful lobby that is seeking to recriminalize street sales, and that is the legal cannabis entities. So not only are you out-competing the brothers and sisters selling weed on the street on price and convenience, those legal cannabis entities, no matter what their color are, have a class interest in sending the police to continue to put those folks out of business because now they're competing with them. So going
Can
beyond...
Can I just say...
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, and that's partially because of the nature of the taxation. And that's why it's so dangerous, because not only if they're not a concerted, strong movement around capturing the tax revenue, but in many states, the people who do have a strong movement in capturing the tax revenue from legal cannabis are the police, who are arguing they need more money to enforce all the anti-high driving and legalistic procedures that come with legal cannabis. So the point that I think we're trying to end on is these are the nuances of how to navigate power that get lost when we have corporate media, buying power, and ownership over-determine how we understand things politically. So I think that's a great place to end. Dr. Jarrett Ball, tell people where to get the book, man.
Everything about the book is at imixwhatilike.org and at imixwhatilike for all your relevant social media. I greatly appreciate what you all are doing and the organizational work in particular that will help deal with these nuances. And of course, I appreciate the time on this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Appreciate it. Enjoyed our conversation with Jarrett Ball. Many folks are asking how they can be helpful and support people doing forms of radical social change in this moment. We at LBS work on issues of police accountability, but also issues of community-based economic development, and as we talked about a little bit at the end, things like reparations for the war on drugs 365 days a year, and it's our ability to do that is based upon the small networks of individuals who give us money every month in order for us to remain independent and continue to fund things like In Search of Black Power, our writing, our speaking, and specifically our advocacy and working community. So folks who are interested in supporting Leaders of Beautiful Struggle here in Baltimore can go to lbsbaltimore.com/sustain. Of course, all of our written material and podcasts are on our New Timbuktu website at newtimbuktu.com. And we look forward to continuing to do the work, continuing to educate folks as much as we can about the work and the dynamics around the work, and continuing to go in search of black power. See you soon.